From downtown Milwaukee, welcome to Money Talk with Bob Landis. Each week, professional advisors from Landis & Company Investments discuss the latest financial developments, offering timely insight and long-term perspective.
This is Money Talk for January 3rd, 2020. Cirque du Soleil is coming to town next week, and that's always a good time. The Packers are on a bye this weekend, and the team with the best record in the NBA, your Milwaukee Bucks, host the Spurs Saturday night. We're all familiar with e-scooters. They're everywhere like locusts, including the Autobahn in Germany. That's right, a couple of good old German boys took their e-scooters on the Autobahn. Now, the first question you ask is, what was their blood alcohol level? Well, the answer is 3 times the legal limit. But they should be acknowledged for having terrific balance. Following that theme, a passenger got into a tussle with a cab driver who then shot the passenger multiple times. While he was being attended to by first responders, he asked if someone would get him a beer. Apparently, it's always 5 o'clock somewhere. And in Florida, of course this is Florida, a newly married 26-year-old woman has been arrested on charges. She tried to cash almost $1 million in checks from her 77-year-old husband's account. She faces charges including exploitation of an elderly person. That's comforting to know that the law is out there protecting me from myself. In the studio today, we have Kyle Tedding, Brian Kilb, Tom Pappenfuss, and wrapping up the week, here's Bob Landis.
Thanks, Max. While the market got off to a great start this year, the Dow rising 330 points yesterday, just a great start to the new year. We gave two-thirds of that back. We lost 235 points today. But year-to-date, we're still in the positive territory. NASDAQ up 0.5%. Last couple of days, S&P 500 gained 0.1%, and the Dow is up 0.3%. You know, Kyle, let's get right to it. Last year, the market went up, for the most part, not because of earnings, but because of an expansion of the multiples. As we now know, give or take, earnings were up just a teeny, puny 0.2% last year. Forward PEs went from in the mid-15s to a little over 19. So, folks, what we're talking about is investors bid stock prices higher because they were willing and more willing as the markets matured during the year to pay ever more money for $1 of earnings. So to put this in a context that most of us could relate to, forward PEs average somewhere in the upper 15 range. So you're paying, give or take, $15 for a dollar of earnings. So PEs expanded. The multiples, as I said, went from 15 to a little over 19. And Kyle, here's the point and a request for a comment. Seems to me that at this point in time, the only thing that will take the markets higher is earnings. As you and I both know, earnings estimates, they're guesses, educated guesses, early in the year, they tend to be stronger than they usually pare them back some. But 9.6%, pretty good number. They're anywhere close to that, we'll do pretty well. I think this is going to be the year for earnings. I think it's very unlikely that the multiples will expand from here. And it's going to be one of those old-fashioned years where it's going to be about earnings and interest rates.
You know, I think the year of 2019 really was the year of the expansion of the multiple. And the math there is pretty simple. It's pretty straightforward. When you look at price to earnings of stocks, you simply divide the price of the stocks by the earnings of stocks, and you get this P.E. ratio. And what we saw, as you say, is a move from, you know, mid-15s to almost 19, a little beyond 19 at a couple points near the end of the year. And really, short-term, no reason why stock prices can't dislocate from the direction of earnings. But long-term, earnings and stock prices tend to move pretty similar to each other, that when earnings increase, stock prices tend to increase in a similar fashion. And so the way you get back from elevated P.E. ratios to more typical or more average P.E. ratios is either by decreasing the denominator, that price number, or increasing the denominator, that, you know, that earnings number. And so, you know,
or both,
you know, ideally you get earnings increases and you never see the price go down. But I think for investors, you know, we're going to see prices move here and there. But I think what we expect is that a 10% earnings growth in 2020, maybe slightly better than that earnings growth in 2021, puts us back near average. If prices don't have the same kind of year they had last year, but just are maybe a little bit below average, you don't have to have a huge correction in stock prices to get back to average if you can get the earnings piece to contribute. And so, you know, short term, I think you can see that expansion, as I said, but long term, you've got to have the earnings piece contribute.
Brian, as you know, in late 2018, the market struggled quite a bit with the threat of higher interest rates, the trade conflicts, and now we start this new year having heard from the Fed just recently that they're not going to change interest rates for the better part of this year, and the president at about the same time announcing that they're going to just postpone future trade negotiations with the Chinese until after the election. So the two things that were holding the market back late in 18 into early this past year are now off the table, at least temporarily. I can't think of the last time we had that kind of clarity on interest rates, and now we don't have to worry about trade either, at least for now.
Well, it's funny how those issues, you know, throw in the Brits too, I guess, in terms of at least having some semblance of a direction and where they're going. But it's so funny how those have been such distracting issues over the last couple of years, and now at least they've been deferred in some means. And that gets back to what you and I and Kyle are talking about. Maybe that's why everybody's going to focus on what matters, because there aren't as many distractions as we've had in the last year. And then I think, well, but then you get weeks where you have this conflict with Iran potentially popping up significantly, and there's another maybe a short-term thing, but maybe something that turns into a bigger issue. And it doesn't just seem like you're ever going to completely get away from some of the background noise. But I think some of those bigger long-term issues, at least for now, are in the background a little bit. And we'll pay attention to earnings and see where we go from here.
Tom, one of the things that I struggle with right now is, on the one hand, you've got really strong consumer confidence numbers. They come out month after month from the Conference Board. Unemployment at a 50-year low. People are feeling pretty good about themselves, and the spending reflects that. And then on the other hand, you have CEO confidence levels that continue to fall. You know, one of them is clearly wrong. But it's interesting, in talking to people that either sell to manufacturing companies or help run those companies, that, you know, manufacturing continues to contract. We saw that in the indicators out this week. And I wondered if you'd comment on that, because, you know, the CEOs, the ones that are paying attention anyway, have a pretty good finger on the pulse, and they're pretty glum about their prospects for the year. The Conference Board came out with a survey the other day. Number one fear for CEOs right now in the United States is the fear of an economic decline. Leads the list. Last year was only number three. And we know that consumer confidence isn't a great indicator. Consumer spending, retail sales tend not to start heading down until we're about a third of the way into a recession. By the time the word gets out that things aren't doing so good. But, you know, it's a pretty good disconnect, in my opinion, between what the CEOs that run companies here in America think and what consumers think.
Yeah, I believe the latest number from the ISM Manufacturing Index is that it's at its lowest level since 2009. And so I think naturally the CEOs, CFOs are rightfully glum about the situation, because we have seen quite, you know, repressed numbers. I think why you might be seeing individuals, consumers at a fairly confident level, wages are continuing to go up. You know, household net worth is at the highest level it's been in the last 10 years. Debt service ratios in households are quite strong. Recent numbers looking at just wage inflation, especially at the lower end, I believe it's in just the last month, 20 different states have increased their minimum wage. So we've seen a lot of pressures coming up on the lower end. And as we all know, you know, our economy is predominantly services-based. So you have to imagine that's a good sign of possibly a tailwind for, you know, the average person having a little bit more money in their pocket, that they'll, you know, put that into circulation and hopefully, you know, work towards, you know, generating some greater growth.
You know, I think over the last couple of years, we've had a number of discussions about the mixed bag of data that we keep getting, you know, and how one week you feel good about this, but then something else slows down, and then those things may flip-flop over the months ahead. You know, and now you look at housing, which now is new home numbers, the best they've been since before the financial crisis, and you see some momentum there because of the consumer and everything, and it's never quite as good as you want it to be, but also probably never quite as bad as you think it is too, and that may be where CEOs and others get conflicting signals because they focus on different parts of the pie, you know?
Well, Brian, I think it's been really years that we've had this dislocation between how consumers feel about, you know, the economy and the world more broadly, and how businesses and business leaders feel about the economy more broadly. You know, it's been a long time since we've seen corporate spending at levels that would really be a boost to economic growth. If nothing, they've more been a drag on economic growth. And so you see it now in productivity numbers where companies aren't spending and that's hurt productivity. You see it now in the need to hire more people and this large skills gap that's out there because companies aren't spending on training, they're not spending on equipment, they're not spending on those things broadly that would help their workforce. And so I think, you know, you look at, you know, our concerns about the consumer is a crisis of confidence, right? That if they become so concerned about the direction of the economy, the direction of the U.S. more broadly, they stop spending. I think you've got that crisis of confidence right now in a lot of business CEOs, though, where they haven't spent for so long that they've made their own environment so poor that what it's going to take to get back to where they need to be is so significant. I think the one good piece of news there is that if we do finally see some clarity the way we think we're seeing it now in trade, the way we think we're seeing it in you know, rates from the Fed, that could be a catalyst for some of that spending that we've been waiting on from corporations. And that could be a strong boost then to earnings growth, could be a strong boost more broadly to economic growth. And, you know, I think certainly that would help the consumers as well. So, you know, that could be a surprise to the upside. Certainly not something we're counting on. Certainly, I think a little bit more cautious about the direction we're headed, but potentially that's something that could be a big positive.
Kyle, as you know, the market's got a pretty good lift on Thursday when the Chinese announced that they're lowering their reserve requirements for their banks, which then allows the banks to lend more money out. It's effective next week. U.S. stocks got pretty excited on that news.
Yeah, they absolutely did. And, you know, I think the issue in China continues to be the flow of capital, that you've got money pouring into certain areas, you know, in particular some of these ghost towns that have been written about, in particular into industry that maybe wouldn't have otherwise seen capital if not for some of that lending. But I think, you know, the free flow of capital and the willingness to turn on the faucets a little bit more is going to encourage investors broadly. And then I think you look at just the global picture more broadly, and you look at how U.S. investors have benefited from the strength of the dollar. U.S. investors have benefited from strong returns here in the U.S. in the past couple of years. But it also means that U.S. investors looking overseas haven't seen such strong returns. And so potentially setting up for not just strong returns here, but maybe even some stronger returns than we've seen, you know, as you look into not just the emerging markets, but I think a little more broadly than that.
Brian, the guys like you and me look at dispersion, of course, the difference in percentage terms between various asset classes and the markets. And you have to be struck by how narrow the numbers were last year. You know, we started the year with growth galloping ahead of value. You know, then the baton got passed for a short period of time in the summer to value. But you look at some of the diehard value funds, you know, just 3-4 percentage points behind some of the aggressive growth stocks. Pretty interesting phenomenon. Normally, you know, as you know, it's 11% difference between the best asset class and the worst asset class in stocks in the U.S. It was less than a third of that this past year.
Yeah, it gives me a chance to talk about value a little bit because, you know, I mean, for many years, Bob, you and I have seen value lead the way, and yet it's been years and years since, you know, the value side has been loved. And you know, it wasn't too long ago that you were reading the typical article about value being, you know, gone forever. And gosh, whenever I read stuff like that, I think it's probably time to reappreciate how value plays a role in your portfolio. You know, the more conservative stocks, the safer stocks to some degree. And sure enough, that's kind of when that rally in value happened. And I think to the degree there's more volatility ahead, whether that's true or not, we don't know, but it will speak to the safety of the value side and the role that that may play in people's portfolios. I think valuations also play a role between asset classes. You know, the growthy side got pretty expensive relative to the value side for a while, and as the market, as returns continue to accumulate, that disparity made value more attractive, and you're seeing some of that, I think. Maybe the final point I would make is if interest rates do at least settle and maybe even rise a little bit in the future and banks can make a little bit more in terms of margins, that might help that side of the equation and might also add to the value side a little bit. So don't give up on your value or any of the other asset classes that from time to time will fall out of favor.
Yeah, Brian, I think one more thing in value's favor is that it's a far broader category than it was 10 years ago. It used to be very heavily into energy, utilities, those real high dividend payers, and we've seen more technology names make their way into the value index. We've seen some pretty interesting healthcare names make their way into the value index. And so, you know, as you look at your value portfolios today, it's not simply those high dividend payers anymore, but you've got some of those higher flyers, maybe just because they look a little bit cheaper. And, you know, you look on a sector level, technology stocks were up 50% last year, utility stocks up only 11. So there is some dispersion if you're looking down in the weeds. But if you're looking at those high level categories, which is what I think so many of us like to focus on, it's not, well, we bought this specific utility fund for you or this specific technology fund for you, but rather, we looked to a value manager to make decisions about where the opportunities were within the value category. Those value managers, especially last year, did a great job, I think, of shunning some of those lower growth names and still in the value side, but shunning some of those lower growth names and really focusing on those areas of opportunity that maybe in the past weren't part of the value side.
You know, moreover, when you take a look at some of the value names, you get some protection, some isolation, if you will, from the problems in Asia, specifically in China. I mean, the way to paraphrase it is we energies could care less about what's going on in China. Take that a step further, regional banks, utilities, telecommunications firms, health care companies that don't have really hardly any exposure to Asia is a way to protect portfolios. And the other thought I had was, you know, it's important to remember downside protection. I mean, and I'm going to just generalize here, but, you know, in the financial crisis, growth stocks sank like rocks. They lost over half their value. I should point out that I don't expect another financial crisis in my lifetime. But value stocks lost half that. And so back to, you know, what I mentioned to Brian, you know, you've got some of these value funds that were within 3-4 percentage points of some of the growth stocks. All right, so it didn't make as much, but the defensive positioning that they afford in the value space, I think, is significant. And it's not always true in bear markets that growth loses twice as much as value does. But at some point in time, we're going to be playing defense. At some point in time, we're going to be talking about how to better position your portfolio to survive a hypothetical sell-off coming up. And I think that's the best reason to reposition and to be willing to give up a little bit on the upside in exchange for a whole lot of downside protection.
Bob, maybe just to take that one step further, and when you look at how you're allocating for those kinds of risks, the importance of finding an active manager, the importance of finding a portfolio that really is geared towards that, because if all you're doing when you purchase a fund or all you're doing when you purchase an investment is saying, what is it going to cost me? You miss out on all these other pieces that are so important. And that's why it's, I think, so incredibly important to understand what it is you're getting into, to partner with managers, I think, that talk about risk in a way that you're comfortable with, to partner with people that really see the benefit of that active management, especially in a market where it's not just about buying utilities and energy names, but it's a broader opportunity set. Because ultimately, that's what's going to matter is not how much you paid for it, but how well they protect things when things fall apart.
You know, I think the last thing I would say, too, is it's just one of those simple things. But it's really hard to look stupid if you buy something cheap enough and if you get a good enough deal. And And it's not even buying value per se on the value side, but if you buy a growth stock cheap enough and get a good deal, you can look pretty smart. And I think, you know, you limit the downside, and if you understand why something is cheap and feel you're getting good value for that thing, you can make it on the upside too, you know. And in a market such as this where pretty much everything's gone up for a long time, I think that active management, they can search and get, you know, presumably a better deal for certain selected securities. It's going to add a lot of value to the mix. And probably, as you say, Bob, protect you on the downside as well.
I was just going to add, if, you know, we talk about, I think a lot of us have talked about anticipated volatility coming into the year, into an election year, and even to your point earlier, Brian, with kind of different contrasting viewpoints of how things look, either from the manufacturing standpoint or from the consumer standpoint, you're going to start to value the, you know, the PEs and the ratios. You're going to own something that's good quality and maybe pays a steady stream of income to kind of, you know, even out your returns and soften some of that volatility for yourself. So I think it makes a lot of sense coming into 2020.
Well, folks, that's the end of yet another Money Talk. Thanks for listening. Good luck to Marquette men's basketball as they go against top-ranked Villanova tomorrow. Go Marquette. We'll talk to you next week.
Thank you for listening to Money Talk with Bob Landis. If you have a financial question you want answered on next week's show, email it to moneytalk@landis.com. To keep informed throughout the week, visit our Money Talk page at landis.com.